So we have a few new people here tonight, and I noticed that they were struggling a bit after maybe the first sitting. 30 minutes is a long time when you're new to this practice. And I wanted to make a few comments about that, just so nobody gets discouraged after the first experience and says, this is just not for me, or I'm not cut out for this. I'm going to try something different. And I also tonight want to talk a little bit about the Zen perspective on heaven and hell. So I'm going to start this whole issue of being a beginner at something that's difficult. And I thought that I would mention my own experience. When I was 35, I had a very severe flare-up of an arthritis condition that I had since I was about 19 or 20. It's called ankylosing spondylitis. And thankfully, it's an arthritis condition that burns out when you get to around 40 or 45. So I was very lucky. I had a rather mild case. But at age 35, I had a severe flare-up. It was so severe, I actually thought I was going to die of it. And it was very disabling. And I continued working in the ER day after day. At night, when the pain was worse, because it was worse when you're immobile, I would be awake most nights and just go to work exhausted during the day, and it was extremely painful and extremely difficult. The only reason I'm bringing this up, aside from the fact that it's part of the human condition, is that when it started to get better, which was about 9 months after it started, you can imagine how long that 9 months felt to me, I was not able to run the way I used to run because it was too painful. So a friend of mine said, Paul, do you have a bike? Why don't you get on your bike? It's non-impact, and we'll go for a ride. So I said, sure, and we went for a ride, and sure enough, it felt like total freedom. I was able to exert, I was able to fly through the air. I had this machine that was multiplying my power, making me feel super. And it didn't hurt. So I continued with it, and I got very deep into it, and I actually became a competitive cyclist. And this story, I'm sure, has been repeated thousands of times around the world, but for me, I began looking for people to ride with, and I found the UMass racing team in Amherst and started training with them. And met some locals, including someone my age named Steve, who was a tremendous racer. He had many wins, many, many wins, going back about 20 years at the time I met him. He started racing when he was in the early 20s. I kept on going, and I trained solidly for about a year and a half, close to 2 years, and then I finally decided to enter my first race. And I thought I was ready. I had a very nice bike. I was really fit. I had turned my health around. I had shaved my legs. I looked like a bike racer. So I entered my first bike race. And I remember flying down the road as fast as you can imagine going. Everybody going as hard as they could, and I'm in a pack of riders. And it was extremely exhilarating. It was so much fun and so scary, all wrapped into one. I didn't know how people could ride that hard and that fast, so close to each other. And then we hit the first climb. Now, one thing you need to know about bike racing is that most road races, particularly in New England, have climbs in them. And the climbs are what really separates out the pack. So we hit this climb, and I see people flying up this climb. And about halfway up, I see the whole pack riding away from me, and I'm all in the back, and it's just going down the road, and I never caught him. And I finished, I think, last. And it was very disheartening, to say the least. But I said, well, you know, I'm learning, so I'll enter my second race. And my second race, same exact thing happened. Last. I thought I was fit. I was 37 years old. I was racing in my age group, 35 plus, which turned out to be a very difficult age group because these were the really experienced racers, and a lot of them were former national champions and what they call Category 1 and Category 2 races, all categories get mixed in this field. It took a long time, and I remember I was riding with Steve, my friend Steve, once, because he kind of became my default coach. And we were hitting some climbs, and he would just fly up the climbs. And after we got over the climb and I kind of caught up out of breath, I said, "Steve, I don't think I can do this sport. I think there's something wrong with my body. I just don't think I have what it takes." And he said, "Paul," he said, "it takes 5 years. You got to be patient. You got to stick with it. I guarantee you your body will change. It's a slow, gradual process." So I didn't stop and I kept on going. And sure enough, about 5 years later, I had a breakthrough year where I won 5 races, finished in the top 3 in 15 races, and won a couple of titles. And then I had tremendous confidence after that. But the reason I bring this up is that there's just no way that someone new to Zazen can sit like someone that's sat for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. It's not possible. And it's going to be difficult at first. And one thing I can promise you, and it won't take you 5 years, it might take 5 weeks or a few months, it will get much easier. And it will get much less painful and difficult and frustrating. Now, what you need to do on your own at home is not punish yourself. Just sit 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes, work yourself up to maybe 20 or 25 minutes. That's plenty of time when you're doing good intent Zazen. Find a posture that you can maintain, and when you come to sit with a group, don't pick a posture that's too difficult that you know you can't maintain. Now, it's going to take time to learn your body and learn this practice and kind of settle into it. And just like I did with my friend Steve and a lot of other riders, you'll have coaches, natural coaches, that have said, "I've been down the same exact road. I totally understand. I get it." So I don't want you, after one experience, to be discouraged or feel like this is too hard, too difficult. It's just not for me. Stick with it. It's very, very important. Now, Buddhism is unique in one particular way, in that it is the only religion I know of, the major religion, that is not founded on any beliefs. It has no truck with belief. It's not about belief. What is it about? It's about your actual experience. And beliefs actually get in the way of your knowing your actual experience. So, what is it? What's the point of it? Is it just to say, "Oh, here's my experience"? No. Buddhism is a religion not founded on the promise of some future heaven realm if you do everything right, if you cross all the T's and dot all the I's. You'll get to pearly gates after you die, and then you'll be permanently happy wearing a white robe. It doesn't have any of that in the religion. It really is a religion of enlightenment. It's about enlightenment. Now, what do I mean by that? Enlightenment has nothing to do with the future. Enlightenment is this moment now. This moment. Now, when people get that, when they get this moment all the way down to the rock bottom, it really does change a lot of things. There is a great happiness that can come from it, but there's still a lot of work to be done, lifetimes of work, because the old habit patterns pull you back into the ordinary way of thinking, which is oftentimes very oppositional. Now, when we start out as beginners, we hear about awakening, enlightenment, Kensho. We're told that it's possible for every one of us, that it's right here under your nose if you could only awaken to it and only see it. And it's natural then to begin to put people like your teachers or people that you are told or read about that have had awakening and had enlightenment, put them on a massive pedestal. They're different than me. They've got something different. They can climb those hills. My body just isn't the same. My mind isn't the same. I've tried. I can't get it. It's just beyond me. So we begin to make ideas about awakening and ideas about people who have had awakening so that they become, in our minds, very special, very different than us, very unique. We honor them. We look up to them. We, in our minds, make them very special. Now, this is common in Zen Buddhism. It's very, very common. And there is a statement, a koan, you could call it, where the master says one line. He says, "There's nothing in particular to realize. Just give up the notion of Buddhas and sentient beings." Or you could say Buddhas as opposed to sentient beings. There's nothing in particular to realize. Just give up your notion of Buddhas as opposed to sentient beings. Give up all of that. That there's something different, something special, something they have that I don't have. If I could only get it, then I'd be happy. And when I can't get it, I'm just going to be miserable. And I don't have it right now, and I have to do something to get it. I have to go through all these steps. Well, all of a sudden, this religion that is not about crossing the T's and dotting the I's and waiting till you die to go to a heaven realm becomes just like that. There's something I need to do. I have to do just certain kind of zazen for many, many years. And I have to have this and that experience, and then maybe I'll become better. Maybe I will perfect myself. This defective, hurting self that seems to have so many problems and lackings. This is the human condition. I totally understand this and get it. This is my condition. So what do we do about that? What do we do? And this master said, "There's nothing to realize. Just give up your notion of Buddhas and sentient beings. Give up your notion that there's special people that have some special characteristics, and then there's people like me who are, quote, ignorant." And we split the world in two. We've made a line in the sand. On one side are enlightened people, on the other side are ignorant people. And that line is made up, but it has a profound effect. It may not be real, but it affects us profoundly when we see it there, when we believe it. Now, to go a little more deeply into this, I had a friend many, many years ago, and this is when I was just starting to read about Buddhism and learning how to do Zazen. I was in my early 20s, and this friend of mine said, "I had this real deep realization, Paul. I want to tell you about it." I said, "What was it?" He said, "Hell is resisting, and heaven is flowing with it." Hell is resisting, and heaven is flowing with it. And what he said really struck me, and I honestly have to say it has stood the test of time. That after many, many years of this practice, I must say that that is still true, just as true as the first day I heard it. Hell is resisting, and heaven is flowing with it. Now, what do we mean by that? What do we mean? When we resist something, and why do we resist something? Because we judge it in our mind. We judge it as bad or wrong or undesirable, shouldn't be like that. When we set up that resistance based on this, what in Buddhism is called discrimination, the discriminating mind, the mind that makes up labels and applies them to a unitary fabric of space-time that is absolute, meaning it couldn't be any different right now. But when we start to split it up and apply labels to it, then we resist it. And what happens when we resist something? Something that had to be there, because everything right now has to be here. It's the end result of all the causes and conditions that led to this moment, and it couldn't have been any different in this moment. But when we resist it, what do? We make it outside of us. Not only have we drawn all these lines and pasted all these labels, but we've drawn the big, deep line between something that I call me, my separate self, and the thing that I'm resisting. And I am then beset by it, and I struggle against it. And it has all sorts of meanings about itself and about me, and the whole thing gets started. Now, this happens in many, many ways, and many of these ways are very subtle. These ways in which we enter our little, in quotes, hell realms, realms of difficulty, struggle, pain. It might be a thought that bothers us in our life, a relationship, an idea about ourselves, a memory of something we did that we feel terribly guilty about. So many things. Come on, we're human beings. We all understand this. And when we resist it, when we fight it, when we try to make it go away, try to counteract it, it becomes very much like a tar baby. We get stuck to it. It solidifies. It stands there. It seems not to be moving. And we also seem to be stuck too. We're on one side of that line and we're stuck. We become this small self faced by a negative big thing looming over us. And that is a kind of hell realm. Now, what's heaven? Heaven is not when you get rid of that thing. Heaven is not when you've changed it into something that you want. And one of the reasons for that is that, let's say you do change the situation. Nothing stays the same. That situation is going to change again into something different. It's constantly changing. The Buddha said that that was one of the three marks of existence. Matter of fact, the first mark of existence, in other words, the first characteristic of everything that can possibly be known, is dukkha, meaning unsatisfactoriness, incompleteness, suffering, if you will, if you resist it. The second mark of existence is impermanence. So even if you turned it into something that you wanted, you won, you destroyed it, you defeated it, you changed it, you succeeded, you got an achievement, you got your awakening, whatever it might be, it's still in the realm of existence. It's still temporary, impermanent, ever-changing, like a flowing river. And as much as you try to hold on to it, you can't hold on to it. So that's not what heaven is. Heaven is not changing something into the way you like it. It certainly appears that way, and it's certainly marketed that way. I mean, you just have to watch TV and go on the internet and see the advertisements of what it is that you're lacking, that if only you get, you'll be deliriously happy, like the beautiful model with the white teeth smiling at you through the computer screen. But don't buy into it. And I'm sure we all have, and then we realize, well, there's a moment where you feel really satisfied and happy, you've got this new whatever it is, and then after a while it's just the same. Just didn't do it because it's old now, because everything changes, and everything is dukkic, meaning incomplete. I thought there was something out there that if I got it, all of a sudden I'd be fine, I'd be happy, everything would be fixed, but I've never found anything like that. There's nothing out there like that, because the first mark of existence is dukkha, incompleteness. The second mark is impermanence. So what is heaven? So my friend said, heaven is flowing with it. Heaven is not resisting. So what happens when we don't resist the thing that we've been resisting? What is this not resisting? Does it mean lying down and being steamrolled? Does it mean giving up and resigning ourselves to some negative outcome? No, I define it this way. Not resisting is allowing something, anything, a circumstance, a situation, a thought that crosses your mind, a feeling in your body, a mood, allowing it its moment in the sunshine of your awareness. That is flowing with it. Now, what is allowing something its moment in the sunshine of your awareness? There's a name for that. It's called Zazen. That's what Zazen is. There's a poem in Zen. It goes like this. How many times has Tokun, his name's Tokun, T-O-K-U-U-N, he's an old wise master. How many times has Tokun, that idle old gimlet, a saying like this, gimlet is a sharp thing, he's idle, just sits all day, but he's really sharp. This idle old gimlet, how many times has he not come down from Marvelous Peak? He hires foolish wise men to fetch snow, and he and they together fill up the well. Now that is actually, and I love these poems, a poetic description of what we're doing here. This idle old, seems like we're doing nothing, we're just sitting facing a wall. This idle old gimlet, not come down from Marvelous Peak. What is this Marvelous Peak? Is it not the space, the sunshine, within which everything is given its moment without any resistance? He hires foolish wise men. What do I see here in front of me? I see foolish wise men all around me. Very wise and foolish because they no longer make stories about the world. They're not experts on everything. They've stripped off all the labels. They don't know. These folks I see in front of me right now are into not knowing, because not knowing is way more intimate than knowing. And these idle and foolish wise men are fetching snow to fill up the well. Fetching snow. This frozen something seems frozen. This situation, this frozen situation, this difficulty, this thing I've been confronting, this sound, that beeping, that infernal beeping outside when someone opens the door, the people in the coffee room talking and laughing, taking these frozen things and throwing them down the well where they melt and turn to water. And that, my friends, is what we're doing here. So I'll say the poem again. How many times has Tokuin, that idle old gimlet, not come down from Marvelous Peak? He hires foolish wise men to fetch snow, and he and they together fill up the well. Heaven. Heaven is not resisting. Heaven is allowing it its space, its moment in the space of your awareness, in the sunshine of that awareness. Now, I think what I'm going to do, since we just went over one beautiful poem, and mention a koan, as I'll read another koan. And for the benefit of people who may not know Zen really well, there are hundreds, probably thousands of koan, which are poetic stories that are aimed at breaking open your mind. This is not just teaching you facts. These are worked on by Zen students in a profound and deep way in order to break open a piece of this true reality, to expose it. In a sense, they're there as tools to precipitate Kensho awakening. Every koan is like this. Every koan has that nature. Now, the other thing about these koan is they're very couched. Many of them came from a time period in China, the Tang Dynasty, when in Zen circles, it was traditional never to say anything directly, but to say it in a very poetic and roundabout and couched way, so that you have to dig down deep for the meaning and it's not immediately obvious. And the way it's couched oftentimes is a way that hooks your mind and brings you in the wrong direction, just so you can struggle really hard to break through it. So this is the nature of a koan. Koan literally means case record. So let me read one of these koan here. Okay, so this is case number 45 in a collection called The Book of Equanimity. And the main case goes like this. And in The Book of Equanimity, there's 100 cases. And when you have gotten to a certain point in your practice, you will go through these one by one by one with your teacher. Very, very intimately. meditating on them and deeply going into them. When you bring an answer to a koan to your teacher, sometimes words are appropriate, but most of the time it requires a demonstration. In other words, you have to step into the story and express it through your whole body. It's a very different way of communicating your understanding than, let's say, in a classroom, where you just parrot back what you memorize from a book. It's completely different. So this is the main case of this koan, the title of which is The Sutra of Complete Awakening, which was actually a sutra, one of the writings of a talk that the Buddha gave to his disciples. So the main case goes like this, attention, and every case starts like that in this book, attention. The Sutra of Complete Awakening says, be at all times without deluded thoughts arising. Moreover, with regard to all deluded states of mind, do not try to extinguish them. Dwelling in the realm of delusion, do not add discriminating knowledge. When knowledge is absent, do not distinguish reality. So these are the instructions of the Buddha. These are very high-level, advanced, and subtle instructions to his disciples. So let's look at this line by line. The Sutra of Complete Awakening. Well, first of all, this is complete awakening. This is, it's done. Buddha said from the very beginning, all beings have had Buddha nature. It's done already. It's done. We just don't know it. So part of this practice is really getting it, having a profound faith that just as I am, even though I don't feel that way, just as I am perfect. Now, how can I really get that all the way down to the bottom? And that is the spirit of this particular practice called Zen Buddhism. So this Sutra of Complete Awakening, he says, be at all times without deluded thoughts arising. So that is our aim. So what is being without deluded thoughts arising? It's not making any thoughts. The moment there's a thought, meaning a picture of reality, an idea about something, so there's a sound and then the mind follows the sound and tries to figure out what it is, and then puts a label on it, and then makes a judgment of it, and then you're off and running because one thought leads to another, leads to another. That's called deluded thoughts. So he said, be at all times without deluded thoughts arising. That certainly is the aim, and that's what we do in Zazen. Matter of fact, and I mentioned this to some of the newer people here, that there is a kind of Zazen called Shikantaza, which is exactly that. It's be at all times without deluded thoughts arising. You just plunge into this moment exactly as it is. And as the mind quiets down, the moment just comes into awareness. And there's no name for it, no idea about it. You can't distinguish where you end and the moment begins. And that, when it's done properly and it's not easy, is called Shikantaza. So he said, be at all times without deluded thoughts arising. But the Buddha didn't stop there. He said, moreover, with regard to all deluded states of mind, do not try to extinguish them. What does this mean? Thoughts will arise because you are alive. You have a mind. The mind is an organ. The secretion of the mind is thoughts. The secretion of the salivary glands is saliva. Your mind will create thoughts. That's what the mind does. So if these deluded states of being arise, which they will, which includes pain in my legs and why am I doing this, and I'm bored, or I don't know, I've tried and I'm not getting anywhere, or oh, that person, what they said to me, all these states will arise. He said, do not try to extinguish them. Now, what did we talk about before about heaven and hell? That hell is opposing, resisting, fighting with, trying to extinguish, trying to get rid of, battling to the death against these deluded states of being. He said, don't try to distinguish them. Don't try to extinguish them. But he goes further. He says, dwelling in the realm of delusion, do not add discriminating knowledge. Go even further. Not only do you allow anything that arises its moment in the sunshine of your awareness, which I explain and teach to new people doing learning Zazen, is thoughts come in like clouds and they float through. And don't fight them. Just stay with the practice. The cloud floats through. You see the cloud, but stay with the practice. Stay with it, because then you're not attaching to the cloud. You're staying with the practice. And the cloud passes through. Now, do not add discriminating knowledge. Don't judge it in any way. Don't make any assumption about it. Don't make it good or bad. Okay? Discriminating knowledge means something that's on one side of a line that I've created and something on the other side. Black and white, right and wrong, Republican and Democrat, whatever it might be, male, female, all these things. In this place, I'm not talking about out in the real world where you have to have a map well drawn and navigate by that map, but hopefully be able to put it down at any time you want to, and all the time you're using it, seeing it as a map and not the real world, and then you become a very skillful person in that world out there. But in this place here, this place where we are right now on Marvelous Peak, we learn to put the map down and just be with what arises. So he says, dwelling in the realm of delusion, do not add discriminating knowledge. Delusion happens. You get lost in a thought. It's all right. Bring yourself back to your practice. Don't add discriminating knowledge. So when I'm doing my practice, it's one, two. There's nothing discriminating about that. Or if you're doing the koan mu, it's mu, mu. The thought arises and you say, everything is mu. This thought is mu. This feeling is mu. This struggle is mu. This depression is mu. I have not added a discriminating knowledge to that. What have I done instead? If I haven't added discriminating knowledge, if I haven't tried to extinguish it, what have I done? I've allowed it its moment in the sunshine of my awareness. That's what the Buddha's teaching. Allow everything its moment in the sunshine of your awareness without attachment or rejection. Things flow through. In this space. Now, when we get really good at doing that, it starts to become our natural place. We live from there, not from the place we learned as children and young adults and adults. All the rules and regulations and lines and discriminations and good and bad and all the things that you need to know to survive in the world, but that layer over the world, cover it up, hide it, and make it dead. So here we peel it off. So this is a very enlivening practice. If all of you stick with this, I guarantee you, you will get this down to the marrow of your bones. You can't help but do it. It will happen. So, he said, when knowledge is absent, do not distinguish reality. He's pushing us all the way down. When knowledge is absent, do not distinguish reality. Don't have even any idea of reality. Have no ideas at all. Be so plunged into this present moment that that's all there is. It's a kind of darkness. We get very comfortable going into this kind of darkness. It's a darkness beneath all our ideas, beneath all our assumptions, beneath all our names, beneath everything we ever learned. And we enter that space fearlessly, and we hang out there and we learn about it. We take all this frozen snow and we throw it down the well, this deep, deep, deep well. Okay. I've gotten quite poetic and I've gone too long, and I think we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. So what we're going to do now